Hello, and welcome to Data is Plural, the podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Singer-Vine. This episode's guests are George Ho and Saul Quanson, whose crossword datasets were featured in the Data is Plural newsletter in 2021 and 2016, respectively. Without further ado, here we go.
Hi, my name is Saul Quanson, and I've created the XE Software Archive, and I maintain a tool called VisiData. I'm a software engineer, and I love data stuff.
My name is George Ho. I'm a data scientist, and I like crosswords.
So, George, how did you first get into crosswords?
I think it was mostly a product of the pandemic. So me and my roommates at the time, you know, were stuck indoors, had not much to do. And we ended up being very competitive at the New York Times Mini, which I think many puzzle people conceive of as the gateway drug to bigger, better, quote unquote, real puzzles. And it certainly was for me. I was successfully gatewayed into both American-style crosswords and cryptic crosswords.
And what about you, Saul? What was your introduction to crosswords?
When I was a kid, my grandmother used to do the crossword, and I did the crossword with her. And then like some 20 years, 30 years went by even. But then I was working at a company, and we had a very small office, and we had a little kitchenette. And every day, one of the people would print out the New York Times crossword and put it on the kitchenette. And we would kind of all do it as a team. And I really enjoyed that a lot. And in fact, when that manager of that team left as a going away present, we surprised him. I made up a crossword for him, basically, and we substituted it in to the New York Times format and put it on the counters. He didn't know he was doing my crossword until the very end. The central clue was something that was very just relevant to him. And of course, it was a big laugh for everybody. But that was the thing that got me back into crosswords.
And George, you mentioned both American-style crosswords and cryptic crosswords. What are those? What are the differences?
It may be simpler to explain both in terms of the clues and then the grid. So I'll go in that order. The clues for an American-style crossword, what some people like to call vanilla-style crossword, are straightforward and definitional. So for example, Saul's shaking his head, but bear with me for a moment. So for example, one such clue might be like, you know, president with facial hair, or first president with facial hair. They can get, you know, somewhat punny, somewhat wordplay-y, but in general, they're quite, shall we say, straightforward. With a cryptic crossword, or what other people like to call British-style crosswords, there are two parts to each clue. So best to explain with an example. So one such example would be error concealed by city police. And the answer is typo, because in the string of alphabetical characters, city police, the TY in city and the PO in police, the word typo is concealed there, and a typo is a kind of error. It's not as if American style puzzles are only just straightforward definitions. There is some wordplay involved. So for example, like Caesar dressing ? Might be toga in the sense that it's something that Caesar might have worn as opposed to like the salad dressing. So there is wordplay. There are like tongue-in-cheek definitions. I think everybody agrees that there is a line somewhere, but the line is definitely very blurry, especially the harder you look at it. In terms of the grids, it's maybe not the most important difference between American and cryptic crosswords, but American crosswords are fully interlocking, so every single letter or every single square is part of two clues, so one across and one down. A British-style crossword or cryptic crossword is sparsely connected, so the exact rules are a matter of, I guess, style, but the upshot is that you really do have to solve every single clue to complete the puzzle.
So both of you have created data sets of crosswords, databases of crosswords. What motivated you to do that?
So I mentioned that I started constructing crosswords because of that job that I had with the communal experience we had doing the crossword there. And then I discovered that I really liked constructing crosswords. I constructed some 6 or 7 more puzzles in that year, and I started really getting into it. And as a software engineer, of course, my answer was, well, let me look at a huge corpus of data and then do some analysis on this data to see how things are put together. And it was really difficult to find the data. And especially it was difficult to find the data in a nice prepackaged form. And I am the kind of person, apparently, that if it's hard to do something, I will do it extra hard and then hopefully make it easier for other people along the way.
What data did exist at the time on crosswords?
I actually couldn't find any actual easy data, like in an actual database or in a collection of files. The best that I found was a site called xwordinfo.com, which has the New York Times puzzles in them, I think all of them at this point. And their data is actually really complete and really well presented, but it's all in web format. So if you are looking for something, you can find any given puzzle, but you can't turn it into a data format. You have to scrape their site and turn it into whatever format you want it to be. And so that was around. And so I knew the data was around. And in fact, David Steinberg, I have a lot of respect for him. As a teenager, he organized, they call it litzing, when you take a existing puzzle from print and basically type it into the computer, get all the grid and the clues into a common format. And he organized litzing of old New York Times crossword puzzles. We have all 25,000 or 30,000 crossword puzzles from the New York Times, thanks to the work of his organizational efforts and the people that also litz those things laboriously by hand.
So you got the New York Times from Xword Info. What about all the other crosswords you collected? What other crosswords did you collect?
I basically just kind of hunted around, but really I only found some 5 or 6 sources of crossword data that was readily available. And I wouldn't look too hard. I was just looking for the first cut. It was about 2 months of my work getting what I thought was an adequate amount of data. And after those 2 months were up, I was kind of sick of crosswords. Then I was like, wait a second, I've done all this work. I should at least look at it to a first degree, right? Even if I'm kind of bored. And I did. And literally in that first weekend, as I was playing with it, it became obvious that something was really up. And this actually plays into a thesis that I had been developing over the past couple of years, that if you get the data into a dense enough form, it becomes so easy to explore it that if there are any anomalies on it, and almost every data set has some anomalies in it, then that stuff just kind of falls out. And so one of the things that happened was I was looking for patterns in crossword construction. And I started with almost the simplest possible thing. I had the grids. I was like, well, find me similar grid lines. And there were a lot of them. And I was like, well, that's interesting. Wait a second. And, you know, every question led to more questions. And then it was basically a weekend of exploration and kind of exciting exploration. Like, I didn't know where it was going, but it definitely my heart was a flutter as a data nerd.
And what did you end up finding?
I discovered that the editor of the Universal UCLIC crossword was republishing existing crosswords with pretty minor edits under different names. Basically, he would make up names and re-edit the puzzle and then republish it and make it look like he had fresh puzzles every time. And having discovered that, that turned into a scandal in the crossword community. And once that scandal hit, then it turns out that there was somebody who had been collecting crosswords for decades. Barry Haldeman collected crosswords on his personal computer since the 90s, and he saved them all. And they're just in a giant bucket. And that's what he's passed around to various people over the years. And then that is where most of the crosswords that I have now came from.
I think it's kind of inspiring. You really can do anything you want if you only put enough elbow grease and dedication into it, you know?
And over time, too.
Right? Yes.
Because the puzzles that he got often, like, he got them when they were published and then saved them. And then good luck finding that random publication, which is now out of print and from 1997. Like, it's just, you can't get it anymore.
It makes me wonder, like, maybe I should be breaking down all of the milk cartons that I've bought and storing them somewhere so that, you know, 50 years from now, somebody will know what milk looks like.
I think if you actually did collect milk cartons diligently and different brands and over decades, it would be a fascinating data source anyway. But I mean, you have to do that. And there's a lot of things to do. And I think this is actually the thing. This is one of the problems with data collection, is that data often is collected as a one-time thing. I had an idea. I went and collected all this data. Now I got this data. And now I'm kind of done with it. Whereas the real awesome benefit of data collection is the ongoing process of it. But wow, that's a lot of work. And there's no incentive to do it other than your own personal motivations.
George, what motivated you to collect data on cryptic crosswords specifically?
As I got more and more into cryptic crosswords, I think I went through more or less the same process that Saul had, where I looked around. There were things that, if you squinted, could serve as a database. In the UK, there's a much healthier cryptic ecosystem there. And so they basically have, say, a half dozen or so daily newspapers run a puzzle daily. Some of them run more than one daily. And every day, a variety of blogs publish a new blog with the commentary, but more importantly, a picture of the finished puzzle and clue by clue discussion. So I thought to myself, okay, well, there are these like, you know, HTML files sitting on the internet. There may be, you know, a half dozen to a dozen ways to write blog posts, depending on who you are. So the way that I did it was to scrape these different blogs and do a lot of HTML munging, essentially, where I took apart the HTML, like, okay, where are the clues? Okay, I see it's between this div tag and that div tag. So let me like parse out the clues. Okay, they underline the definition. So where's the underline tag? It's from here to here. That's the definition. You theoretically could, but none of these blogs did encode the grid structure in there. It was going to be an image and not all of them have it. So I just said, okay, whatever, let's give up on that. I'm kind of not interested in that anyways, as like, you know, the form of cryptic crosswords lends itself to clue-oriented data storage, I think. And so what came out of that is basically a table where each row is one clue, maybe with the definition, certainly the answer, and maybe some explanation if there is any. And of course, I know where the clues come from. It's from the same blog post. And from there, I know the puzzle provenance.
I find this fascinating that on the surface, these databases you've constructed are both databases of crosswords. But the sourcing and the data collected is actually quite different. That Saul, your database of American style crosswords comes more or less directly from the crosswords themselves and includes the grid, which is maybe a more important feature in American style crosswords than cryptic crosswords. George, your database, conversely, does not include the grids, in part because the source is not the crosswords themselves, but commentators' remarks on the crosswords, which means, though, you have an extra bit of data that the direct crossword sources don't have, which is this explanation.
Yeah, yeah. Also, you know, selfishly for the data that I wanted to get better at solving and making crosswords. So the explanation was invaluable to me.
So how many crosswords and how many clues are we talking about?
I have about 2 or 3 dozen publications, and as of today, about 85,000 crosswords.
And George, what about you?
Yeah, so I have about 10 distinct publications, and my data set is measured in clues, so I have 640,000 clues, which probably works out to something like 20,000 puzzles.
And so you went so far as to create your own file format, which you call .xd, to store crossword data. Why did you do that?
So it's just a text file, and it's a text file of kind of the most obvious format. Like if anybody saw it, they would understand instantly what it is. It's got the metadata, it's got the grid, and it's got the clues. And you can see if you've ever done a crossword, it would just make sense to you. But it's got some key features that are kind of subtle that were important to me. For instance, in the clues, they're all one clue per line, and the answer is on the same line. So therefore, you can treat the clues and answer pairs independently, more like cryptic crosswords. Whereas in other formats, they are separate. They don't want to have spoilers in the format. And so they have the clues as blank things. And then the answer you have to kind of figure out from the grid. So it was important to me that characteristic was the case. And it was also important to me that it was a text format. Crosswords are inherently text-based, and if everything can be done in Unicode, then let's just use a Unicode format instead of anything binary. Like the .puzz format that almost all crosswords haven't published in for decades is a binary format. And, you know, that's, you know, file formats come and go, but ASCII and Unicode text is forever. And I wanted to make a file format that would be around for 100 years. And even if it doesn't, it's not supported, if all my software rots, which of course it will, somebody else could take this file format and remake a thing that parses it without much difficulty and do that analysis on it, like I said, 100 years hence.
George, your documentation for the data set you publish includes something called a data sheet. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah. So as I was making the data set, I came across an article in some journal club that I was part of, I think it was by Timnit Gebru and a couple of other researchers out of, I think, Microsoft. And I believe it was data sheets for data sets. And the thrust of that paper was, if you're an electrical engineer, you have all of these electrical components, and each component has an accompanying data sheet that tells you, you know, what it is, who made it, what are its operational characteristics, recommended usage, and just all of this like very long form documentation about this like one, you know, resistor that you're holding in your hand. The paper basically argued, well, we should do the same thing for data sets. Just documenting, like, where does this data set come from? How did you make it? Do you intend to continue updating it? If so, on what schedule? What would it take for this data set to completely vanish from the globe? And it's like quite, you know, it was not trivial to fill out this basically form, but I thought it was incredibly worthwhile because, you know, it's been a couple of years now, and maybe I don't even remember the answers to those questions. So writing documentation is a love letter to yourself in the worst case, and much better than that in the best case.
A big thanks to Saul and George for this interview. Our conversation, like all others on the podcast, has been edited to fit into 15 minutes. Additional thanks to Nikhil Sanand, who composed the podcast theme music, and to you for listening. To subscribe to the Data Is Plural newsletter, visit data-is-plural.com.